At the very end of Jesus' life, he put his disciples through a very difficult time because he knew that an even harder time was coming for them, which was when he would be arrested and crucified. It wasn't merely, well, it was twofold. It was one, that the Master wasn't going to be with them anymore in the body, which was going to be difficult enough. But it would also be that all of their expectations of what his life and mission was going to be would all be dashed. There were probably very few among them, maybe some who were quite intuitive, but I think very few among them expected his life to end so suddenly, so young, and so ignominiously. You know, just instead of being the destined one who was going to liberate the Jews from their oppressed position and restore the greatness of their kingdom and so on, and be their uniting leader, instead he was killed in a humiliating way. Yes, he was resurrected. And yes, he gave to them a deep experience at that point on the day of Pentecost, and the Om vibration came, the Comforter came as he promised. But in that week before he died, and in the months leading up to that, he was challenging his disciples to come to a deeper and deeper level of intuitive relationship with him, so that their intuition would carry them through the confusing events that were to follow. This is not just something that I'm making up, but this is how Master interprets that whole part of the Bible. And it began really strongly when Jesus started the commanding them to eat my body and drink my blood, which has now been interpreted in a symbolic way. But when he said it, there was no explanation. So the disciples had to weigh the words and actions of this man that they had trouble understanding and putting into any rational context against a kind of experience which was completely outside of the relatively trivial confusion by comparison of him giving them a teaching that they didn't understand. Now, the disciples who left Jesus at that point, and the Bible says that many left at that point, they just couldn't get it. It's like he'd been very reasonable and now he wasn't, and so, well, that was nice and we learned something from him, but now we have to go on our way. And there's this very fine line in discipleship where, on one hand, we absolutely must bring to bear every refinement of consciousness that we have. And that certainly includes our ability to discriminate and our ability to think. I recall once a man who was at Ananda was... He had sort of a curmudgeonly nature, and he was disputing with Swamiji over some point or another, and it was a little slightly disturbing because he was a curmudgeonly character, so his way of disputing wasn't always attractive. But after he walked out, I remember Swami Kriyananda just shrugging his shoulders casually and said, "Oh, I prefer someone who presents an honest argument to me than just says yes without even thinking about it." And I recall that Nitai, in talking about teaching the children and how much spirituality to impose or to expect or to even to teach the children, he said you have to walk that fine line where you don't want to produce mindless rebellion just because they're tired of being pressed, or mindless acquiescence because you've made it the way to win favor. He said it has to be that point where They're inspired by the truth of what you're presenting, and that's what they want. So, as disciples, we have to be very wide awake. And in the life of Sri Ramakrishna, who was an avatar in the 1800s, and his foremost disciple, who was Swami Vivekananda, who was a man of formidable intelligence and willpower, to say the least. And Vivekananda was not going to be taken in, and even though he felt this extraordinary tie with Ramakrishna, and in fact Ramakrishna had even given him these superconscious experiences, remarkable, Vivekananda was still very intent, and he watched Ramakrishna carefully and challenged him on many points and spied on him to see if he actually lived up to the high principles that he was teaching. And many of the other disciples were horrified by Vivekananda's seemingly disrespectful attitude. But Ramakrishna, the guru, was all for it. He said, of course, you know, don't take anything just because I say it. You must test it and find out for yourself if it's true. And of course, when Vivekananda became persuaded, then no power on heaven and earth could move him after that. Because every aspect of his consciousness had been brought to the light and brought into the light of the Master, and it had proven itself. And every doubt, subconscious doubt, every intellectual question, every one of them, Vivekananda had the courage, you see. Had had the courage to just bring it forward, put it next to the light of the Guru, see what the reality was, and then had sufficient faith in himself to be able to make the commitment and hold it. You know, once decided that was where he was going to be. And so the disciples of Jesus were given that same chance, because the relationship with the Master is a very interesting one, because on one hand, as I was saying, you have to bring every aspect of yourself into it, but it isn't based on the conscious mind. The conscious mind takes everything apart and then sees if it adds up again. But the superconscious mind intuits the fact that it all comes together and sort of relies on that fact. It knows it first, and then the conscious mind begins to add up the pieces in the direction of superconsciousness. That's the only way I can think to say it. And what we have to work with in our discipleship, and whether the challenges come because of something that Master says, or something that Swamiji says as Master's representative, or some experience that comes to us in our own spiritual life where we find that we don't have quite what we hoped we would have, and we have to ask ourselves whether or not the fault is in the Master or in my attunement to him. And we have to go through that again and again and again and again and again and again and again. Because each time we come around to it, you know, everything is slightly different. And it's a question of whenever we become afraid, whenever we become anxious, whenever we think that this time, this path will not be adequate. You know, I have to go somewhere else for inspiration. I have to go to some other writing to get it clear. I have to go to some other sangha to have what I want. And I'll take a little of this and I'll take a little of that. And this one will work and I like a little of that. And I go here for this and there for that. But when we do that, we deny ourselves the opportunity to really go into infinity by becoming deeply in tune with one ray. It's a very hard thing to understand, and especially the Western mind really rebels against it. We sort of think that more is better, more variety is better, that our second chakra So very creative. It's always moving around and looking for something new. Somebody asked me recently, they were playing for me a very nice Indian chant, a Sri Ram, Jai Ram chant that they'd learned somewhere else that they were. And then he asked me, he said, what does Swami Kriyananda do about the Indian chants? My answer was, well, Master only played a few of them, so Swamiji has to do it as Master did it. And I just made that simple statement. And then I answered saying that when Swamiji himself went to India and had the opportunity in this incarnation to tune into the Indian bhav and really hear their bhajans and learn, you know, some of the really deep devotional Indian songs, he everything in him responded to it. And when circumstances caused him to have to leave India and not be able to go back, and it was during the decade that he couldn't go back to India that he had to be in America, at the beginning of that time, he played many Indian chants. We often sang Sanskrit chants, and Swami would sing the Indian devotional songs, and it, you know, it was really exquisite. And then at a certain part, he started backing away from it more and more. And later he said it just like this. He said he himself felt so much attunement with that bhav, that devotional mood. He said that when he went too far into it, he couldn't relate to America. And when he went too far into it, he couldn't remember, you know, all this work that he was supposed to do. He just moved over into that side. But that wasn't what the guru was asking of him. And then even at a certain point, he had to say to all of us, he said, Master was Indian. He was raised in that tradition. And he came to America, and he started a work. And he didn't bring that with him. He could have so easily. He could have had us singing Sri Durga Jai Jagadamba, you know, Sri Saraswati, Jai Krishna, Jai Krishna, Jai Rama, Jai Rama, very easily. Shiva, Shiva, Shiva. He could have done that so easily, but he didn't. And he didn't because it's a new reality. It's a new vibration. He didn't come here just to take an old tradition and export it from the East to the West. He didn't do it for reasons that I don't know. I can't articulate them. I can respect it, but I can't necessarily say it, what it is. But so Swamiji said, therefore, we need to honor what he did. Now, there's two responses to that. One response is to fold your arms and say, why? And in The Path, Swamiji is honest enough to write in the chapter, The New Path, the chapter called Attunement, which is a brilliant chapter. He says, at one point he said to Master, Master, I have some ideas for the garden at Mount Washington. And Master's response was, oh, speak to Ananda Mata. She knows my will for the garden. That was the phrase he used. And Swami was honest enough to say, can't I have my own ideas about anything? You know, just like even the garden? Does he have to have his will for the garden like that? And then Swamiji goes on to write how those disciples who were living with Master but always insisted that I want to do it this way and I want to do it that way and I have a right to my opinion and I can do it like this. He said they never found in the relationship with the guru what they were really seeking, because they always drew this little circle around themselves. This much of his consciousness I will take, but no more. Now, it's a very, very interesting reality. That's the only way I can say it. And I think the only way that we can live it is to be absolutely sincere. Now, to be completely sincere is not the same to be self-justifying or self-enclosed. It's to say, Lord, what good will it do me to have my own opinions? As Master himself said, or Lahiri said to, Sri Teshwar said to Master, I'm not sure which one of the gurus said it, but basically, My life was guided, as he put it, by whims and fancies until I attuned my will to the divinely guided will of my guru. I love that phrase, whims and fancies. That it seems like a good idea, let's do it. But there's a tremendous difference between just sort of like this and having our consciousness just be really surrendered and united with that divine ray. Now, the sincerity of it is you can't fake that. You can't just say, oh, yes, sir. Yes, whatever you want, sir. Even if you're just saying it inwardly, I'll do that. Yes, of course. I would never have a thought that wasn't what Guru wanted me to do. Or out of fear of never having a thought that Guru didn't want me to do, we imagine that Guru endorses everything we want to do. That's another very convenient way to make it work. Oh, what a glorious coincidence. I prayed and he agreed with me. That's another way to make it happen. But what's really being asked of us is not something that comes fast, not something that comes just casually, not something that comes because, oh, now I've taken my initiation. It comes because every day, every single day, we ask ourselves, you know, how can I be better? How can I be more selfless? How can I listen more carefully? How can I understand more deeply? How can I really see what he's trying to intend with this? And just be in this constant state of eager interest to know what it is. Swami Kriyananda, over the course of 40 years of my listening to him, has repeated himself endlessly. Because he'll be in a room and there'll be 50 people in the room and 49 of them have been there for 25 years and two of them have just arrived. So he'll bring those two people up to date. And everybody else gets to hear it all over again. Over and over and over again. I was saying to David recently, I have understood things in completely new ways that I have literally heard for 40 years. But there's a desire to understand. There's a desire not to say, oh, there he goes again. Oh, I've heard this one before. Oh, there's that same old line from Master. But each time we hear it, to ask ourselves, if God is ever new, how can I understand this more deeply? And it becomes this very interesting dance of just, Swami Kriyananda has the most creative, the most intelligent consciousness I have ever met, ever. I mean, not, you can't even begin. And yet it's a consciousness that's absolutely dedicated not to itself. It's dedicated to being in tune with another. But the paradox of attunement is that it liberates us. And the commitment to being ourselves makes it impossible to be ourselves. Because we don't have we're not original. We're not coming from our point of origin. You see, attunement with the guru makes us genuinely original. Because it brings us back to our point of origin. Otherwise, we're just picking up our ideas from here, there, and everywhere. A friend was speaking to me yesterday, and she's just starting on this path, and she's just beginning to try to align her life with the principles of self-realization. You begin to study these teachings, and you begin to learn them, and all of a sudden, you begin to wonder about everything. I was bemused, because the question was a very specific one. Can I kill spiders or do I have to carry them outside? You know? I told her, well, David kills them and I carry them outside, so take your choice there. In fact, actually, if he's not home, I just let them be wherever they are. You know? But it was a very real question. You can kill them because Master says that the human body is a higher form of life because it has the capacity to attain infinite consciousness with his nervous system. And therefore the human body needs to be protected from danger. and lesser forms, you know, where insects are allowed to proliferate, disease always comes in. So it's all right to do that, as long as you're not, as I said to her, going outside and looking for things to kill. You know, in other words, it's not a desire to kill things, it's just a desire to keep the environment sattvic. But if you want to carry them outside, go right ahead and carry them outside. But you see, in every little thing that we do, it's very important to ask the question, you know, what is the principle of self-realization as it applies to this? And not in a general sense, as Master taught it, as Swami interpreted, as it's lived at Ananda. And you really have to bring it down that far, because this is where we are. This is where we are. This is the pathway that's been given to us. And I don't mean by that, you know, everybody gets so nervous if you ever are very specific and committed. Of course we're specific and committed. It doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that unless we concentrate and really embrace, then when the tests come, we're not standing anywhere. If we're standing half here and partly over there and sometimes this place and that place, when the wind comes, we fall over. And believe me, the wind comes. It always comes. But if we have rooted ourselves so that every aspect of our life in a very subtle way is attuned, because we've always referred it back to one single reality. What did the Master say? The Master's love for me. Now, if you're at a point where you don't know whether this path is yours or not, if you're at the point where you're sincerely trying to understand, you still have to give it a very serious effort. You have to be like Vivekananda. If you're still shopping, that's perfectly fine, you know. You date for a while usually before you get married. You have a few men or women in your life before you know enough to know that this is the one that you really want to be with. But once you commit yourself to love, you really have to work on it. And you have to really align your life with those principles. Then the most extraordinary thing happens. It's just, it's indescribable. It's not only is it blissful, it's described by this song, you know, there is no other love like the Master's love for me. There's that beautiful hymn that we sang sometimes too, when we walk in the garden alone, you meet Jesus in the garden. It's a beautiful song. And it says, you know, in the love we share as we tarry there, none else has ever known. And I've sort of partly objected to that verse and wanted it to be changed to, it's the sweetest I've ever known, because everybody knows it. But on one hand, maybe none else has ever known it. Because every individual has a unique relationship with God. And the Master's love for me is the sweetest I've ever known. What that's actually saying is, I mean, what does the heart long for so deeply? It longs for love. It longs to be loved. And it's so, that song is so dear, because it talks about what the Master is giving us. And yes, it's always a circle and we have to give back. But the reason that we're so inspired to do this is because of what we become when we do this. We live in this reality. And then you begin to live in this fascinating, delightful reality where your brain is working better than it's ever worked before. Someone remarked to me, he went to Ananda for the first time, a very, very bright man who was accustomed to being sort of one of the smartest men in the room as a rule. And he went to Ananda and he came back and he said, you know, the people, Ananda Village, he said, the people at Ananda are so intelligent. And I sort of said, I thought about it for a moment. I said, well, yeah, I guess I've just grown used to it. I'm just accustomed to the fact that when you're surrounded by Ananda devotees, you're in a very highly intelligent atmosphere. But then I reflected on it later and I wrote to him and I said, you know, it's not that they're all so intelligent. You know, they might not all have been admitted to Dartmouth and Yale and Stanford and although a great many of them have been. But what it is they're not self-justifying. They're not ego-attached. Their desire is to be in tune with an infinite truth. And that liberates the intelligence. Whereas many people who are smart, really not particularly bright, really, because they're so committed to a point of view. But when your commitment is to just be in tune with the guru, as I was starting to say, your intelligence works like it's never worked before because it's inspired by intuition and it's informed by these extraordinary principles of self-realization which just make it possible to know things that you just couldn't know otherwise. And the principles of self-realization make sense. You know, you have karma, you have reincarnation, you have the yugas, you have self-realization as the goal, and just like all of a sudden the chaos is gone. You know, there's this orderly reality that you can apply everywhere. But you discover that the human intelligence exists in this much bigger ocean. And that much bigger ocean, I guess you would call it the ocean of awareness. And so there's this kind of constant awareness of this other thing that's happening, in which all the little things that you normally thought of as your whole life just keep spinning around and doing their thing, and you evaluate this and you wonder about that, and every so often something, he says, eat my body and drink my blood, and you say, my, that's interesting. I wonder what the heck that means. But you don't have to rely on such tiny issues anymore because it all exists in this great ocean of awareness of the Master's love for me, which is the sweetest love I've ever known. And why would I ever want to be anywhere else but there? And so all reasoning becomes measured by whether it keeps you in the heart of that divine love. And whatever keeps you in the heart of that divine love is perfect. You know, so Swamiji loved Indian chanting and it moved him so deeply, you know. But Master didn't do that kind of chanting. So, okay. And you're sincere. You say, I love it. But my guru doesn't do that. My guru has a mission. I'm here to live for him. I don't want to be guided by whims and fancies. I want to be guided by divine will. And every day, and you can, as I say, you can live on many levels. You can sort of fold your hands. When Swami sort of talked to us about that Indian chanting, I rebelled for quite a long time. I remember Swamiji made some other decision about something. Oh, I know, it was when he changed the arati from all the light bearers doing the arati together to just one. I was there when the decision was made. People asked me about it later. I said, look, friends, I argued it from every angle I could think of. And I lost. And that's the way he wants it. If that's the way he wants it, that's just fine with me. What do I care? I remember one time, I'll tell this last story, then I'll let it be. The readings that we used to do on Sunday, we used to read out of a different book, and they were very long. They were very, very long. Really, really long. And you know, I'm a big talker, so I didn't really like need really long readings. I needed a lot of time to do this. And I really didn't like those readings. And there's two parts to this. When Swami wrote the Rubaiyat, and we had this idea that instead of reading those readings, we'd read the Rubaiyat. So we did it a whole year of the Rubaiyat, and then I suggested we do a second year of the Rubaiyat, and we did. And then we were coming around to have to go back to those long readings, and Swami describes what he says. There wasn't email in those days. He got what he described, a tear-soaked fax from Asha, asking if we had to go back to those long readings, at which point he started writing shorter ones, and he wrote a whole year of shorter ones, which he always says, because of my tear-soaked fax. I got thank you notes from all over the world, you know, for that tear-soaked fax. But earlier than that, when I don't know why, but they just irritated me, those readings, really irritated me. We were having some discussion, and Swami offered that I could be the only minister in the entire worldwide Ananda system who didn't have to use them. You know, it's like he plays you. It's like, okay, you're so upset. All right, honey, you don't want to do them. You alone, you don't have to do them. Everybody else has to, but you don't have to do them. And he just offered it to me with a very straight face, but I thought, I don't really think this is where I want to go. So I didn't accept that, you know, private dispensation. But I was still just so irritated about those readings. It just, you know, ate at my mind. We lived, this was long before the community, we lived at this house on Colorado Avenue. I remember because I was in the kitchen. I had a garbage can that you stepped on like that and the lid flipped up. This is the picture. This is how this whole thing happened. And I was just thinking about those readings, just grousing around in my mind about those readings. And I was in the kitchen and I stepped on the garbage and this absolutely unmistakable thought came to me. If you keep complaining about these readings, you're going to leave this path. It's like you start somewhere, you see. You make some little challenge. I like this path, everything except. In this matter, I know a little better. He's really wrong about that. You know, I just don't know why Master said that. This is better. You let one little door open for all of that self-justification and I'm smart too kind of energy to come. And then it just takes over like a plague. And I saw it just as clear as could be. And I had this something garbage in my hand. I just took my resistance to those readings and I just dropped them in the garbage can and I shut the lid. And after that, oh, goody, the 25-minute reading is here. Great, you know. And I mean, later I said to Swamiji, he asked me about it. You know, I said, you know, I still have all my same complaints, but I told him what had happened. I said, it's just not worth it to me. And you see, that's not, you're not really giving up anything because you're completely sincere. But it's just not worth it to you. Because where do you want to be at the end of your life? Right about this? Or free? You know? What allows that sweet love to reach you is your sweetness back, your respect, your understanding, your surrender. And that's, you know, that's our happy birthday present to Master. Because he has one wish. When he blows those candles out on his cake, he has one wish. God realization for everyone. And the best birthday for him is when we say, me too, sir. I'm in it. We'll do it. Where was it that Master said after you agree that you'll be his disciple? Okay, now we'll get to work. Just like that. That's the birthday present he wants, is your commitment. Purification ceremony, remember? Open your heart to me, the Master says, and I will enter and take charge of your life. Think about that. Open your heart to me, the Master says, and I will enter and take charge of your life. And you see, he knows how to get where we're going. We have a vague idea about it, but we're going to get lost. You know, even with the best little navigating system, he knows where we're going. Open your heart to me, and I will enter and take charge of your life. Happy birthday to all of us. God bless you.